Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How sustainable is your lifestyle? As energy consumption spikes along with the temperature, summer seems the ideal season for us Texans to take steps toward reducing our eco footprint. It takes commitment and awareness, but it may not require as much time or even effort as you might imagine. Megan O'Neill is editor of PlanetGreen.com and TreeHugger.com. Her new book, written with Graham Hill, is called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco-Living. Megan, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So first off, you recommend measuring our eco footprint, which actually goes beyond the carbon footprint. What is built into that?
That's right. Well, the carbon footprint, of course, is sort of a measure of how much carbon or greenhouse gases we're emitting as individuals in a certain period of time, usually a year. The ecological footprint takes into account even bigger issues than that, such as land use or how many resources we use when it comes to our natural resources or how much packaging we use. So the ecological footprint is a measure of the entire impact that we have on the environment, not just our greenhouse gas output.
So let's talk for a minute about solid waste. You make this point that is so easy to forget, which is that when we throw something away, it's still out there somewhere.
That's right. I like to say there is no away. We think that we throw things in the trash and off it goes. But the fact is that it really just kind of sits somewhere until it piles up. So I live on an island, so I have sort of a clear idea of where the boundaries of what's around me stops. But I think a lot of us don't. We throw things away, and it's out of sight, out of mind.
I was amazed to read that even fully biodegradable waste, things like food, can sit there unchanged in a landfill for decades.
Yeah, the EPA did some research, I guess sent someone to a landfill with some rubber gloves, and found that they found things like whole cabbages and carrots that had been essentially preserved for 30 years just sitting there. So even these biodegradable things, or even these things that we think of as organic biodegradable things, without sunlight and air, they essentially just sit there and don't degrade. So if that's happening to things that are technically biodegradable, you know, we have to think about what happens to things like plastic that really aren't dissolving at all.
Yeah, you point out that plastic bags get used for an average of 20 minutes, and they take, what, 1,000 years probably to break down?
Yeah, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 years. Scientists aren't exactly sure because they haven't been around that long. But, yeah, they're not breaking down, so they're just sort of sitting there and sitting in the landfills.
So I guess what we need to start is reducing what we consume in the first place, and you call it waste prevention. What are the most obvious candidates off the top that we can sort of prevent ourselves from using in the first place?
Well, plastic bags, like you just mentioned, I think are an awesome example. And, you know, bringing that canvas bag to the store or even reusing the plastic bag that you already have is a great way to just cut down on the amount of stuff that you're using. I also recommend that people just start to think about, you know, what things are packaged in when you're at the grocery store or when you get takeout food or when you get your lunch. There's so much packaging around everything from, you know, a battery that you buy for a camera to, you know, the sushi that you get at takeout at dinner. And all of that stuff is typically ending up in the garbage.
And you also suggest something called a product service system, which basically allows us to use certain items without actually having to own them.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, a library is a classic example of a product service system. Something that's more modern is something like Zipcar or Netflix. And the idea behind this is that we're sort of dematerializing the goods that we use. So who cares if someone else has seen that DVD of Caddyshack before, right? All you care about is the entertainment of the film itself. You don't really care about owning that piece of polycarbonate disc. So the idea that we can sort of share resources but still get the same value out of the product itself is the idea behind a product service system.
And then one of the things you say we can do is go and get at least one of the magazines or newspapers we subscribe to and cancel that and go online.
And get it online, yeah. So, you know, I used to read the New York Times paper every day, and now I read it online, and it's just as enjoyable. And, in fact, I like it more because my hands don't get dirty.
A third of what ends up in landfills is paper.
That's right. Paper is a huge, huge, you know, just physical resource that ends up piling up and not getting recycled, unfortunately. On top of that, deforestation is one of the main causes of global warming, and we are using just tons and tons of virgin forest every year to create things from, you know, facial tissue to newspapers to computer paper. So what consumers can do that really makes a big difference is look for paper that's made from post-consumer recycled paper, and that ensures that you're using paper that's being made from resources, you know, resources that have already been used once that aren't coming from virgin resources.
Well, very often, Megan, when people start recycling, paper is the first thing they look to. Mm-hmm. But you also point out a problem with something called downcycling. Can you explain that?
Sure. Downcycling is the idea that we take a product, and when we recycle it, it's actually becoming a lesser product. So, you know, something like plastic, this is often happening with. So we're recycling things, but they're being turned into something that's another product that's basically just being delayed on its way to the landfill. So what we're want to look for as a society at large are materials that can constantly be recycled into products of the same caliber. So an aluminum can is actually a pretty good example because this is something that can be recycled into an aluminum can again.
That's just as good as the original aluminum
can. That's
right. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of misconception about the amount of energy it takes to recycle. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. You know, a lot of people think that, oh, recycling, it takes so much energy to do. But the truth is that recycling actually saves more energy than it consumes. So, of course, yes, the idea is to reduce the amount of stuff that we use in the first place, and that's going to save the most energy of all. But recycling an aluminum can, again, is actually 95% more efficient than creating that aluminum can from raw materials. So that's a pretty significant savings.
So in other words, if you were to go out and mine new aluminum, it would take that much more energy than getting another can.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And what about the bottled water issue? This was, I think finally people are starting to recognize how much they're throwing away every day. But there are, what, hundreds of thousands of these used every month?
Yeah. Americans buy just about 30 billion single-use plastic water bottles a year. And unfortunately, even though many of them are recyclable, a lot of that is ending up in the landfill and not being recycled. So, you know, bottled water is sort of something that's grown out of a marketing idea. The truth is we get delicious, fresh, healthy water delivered to our fingertips, you know, for free, practically. So it's very important to try to cut the bottled water habit. That's a great way to cut down on the waste that you generate. On top of that, the biggest impact from bottled water is actually from it being transported. So it's being transported from France or Fiji or Italy to us here in America, and the amount of fuel that it's taking to ship water is really causing a great amount of impact in terms of carbon emissions.
Well, and ironically, I guess some of it's from Cleveland and Topeka and places that are not nearly so romantic anyway.
Well, that's true, too. You know, most of the bottled and much of the bottled water is not any better than the tap water that you're getting. And in fact, it's less fiercely regulated.
And for a while, there were these rumors going around. People said, well, if you reuse a bottled water, you know, if you refill it, you're going to have all kinds of germ issues. That's not actually the case. Is that right?
No. You know, to reuse the number one plastic bottles, which is what water bottles are made out of, is actually pretty safe. You know, I wouldn't recommend doing it to the point where that bottle is cracked or breaking. You could certainly have some bacteria issues there. But the number one plastic is actually a pretty solid plastic that you can reuse. So if you do get your, you know, Poland Spring water bottle or your Evian or whatever it is, you can reuse that at work or in your car, and you're going to be safe.
One thing that's really interesting, I think, in the book is you talk about making our own cleaning products. What are the base materials that we can have on hand to sort of make a variety of things to keep the house clean and germ-free?
Yeah, vinegar and baking soda are pretty much the two staples, and you can use them to clean everything in your house from your countertops to your silver. I use those all the time in my house, and they are completely safe and really cheap. The other thing I use a lot is lemons.
And so you just basically put those with water, I guess, and kind of scrub down. Is there a special formula?
Yep, that's what I do. I use when I use vinegar, I use one part vinegar to five parts water. And I just reuse a spray bottle that I have on hand, and I use that to clean the countertops and, you know, other surfaces in the house, the tabletop, the bathroom. Lemons I use for, I just cut them in half and use them to clean my pots. If I cook seafood in particular, it cuts the smell, and it also acts against bacteria. Vinegar you can use in your laundry as a fabric softener. Obviously, it doesn't have any harsh chemicals in it, so it's safe for your skin, and it's also not causing harm once it goes down the drain.
You talk about smell. A lot of people associate the smell of bleach with something being really clean.
Yeah, they associate the smell of bleach or, you know, these quote-unquote fresh-smelling cleaning
Pine-Sol,
products or,
right.
air fresheners. And, you know, really, bleach and these synthetic fragrances are actually very bad for our health and for the health of the planet as well. So we do have to retrain our minds a little bit to think about what fresh really smells like. And I think usually, you know, a lot of people say green, you know, green cleaning doesn't have a scent. It smells like nothing or it smells like fresh air.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Megan O'Neill from treehugger.com. Her new book is called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco Living. Let's speak to John in Richardson. Hi, John. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was back to the recycling and the bottled water issue you raised earlier in the show. Some states have a deposit on plastic bottles. I'm wondering why more states don't do that, if there's some type of organized opposition to recycling by incenting someone, maybe not the purchaser, but someone to return that container.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I know that this is Rhode Island, and this is actually a sort of a hot topic right now, and my husband actually walked into the store down the street, and the gentleman who owns the store in our neighborhood had out a petition against the bottle law, and he said, "Oh, you have to sign this petition." And my husband said, "I'm not signing that. That's crazy. I'm all for it." And he had this concern, the store owner, that he was going to be infiltrated with tons of people returning their bottles, and that it was going to be a huge burden on his business. But the statistics show that the states that do have the bottle return deposit laws actually have a higher rate of recycling. So I think it's a pretty good idea.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Quickly before the break, we'll take a call from David in Louisville. Hi, David.
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Back to the water point. I absolutely agree that I forget what it's a tetra something cycline that's in those clear water bottles. It's horrible for the groundwater, and the worst thing in the world can happen is those end up in a landfill. So as I'm driving along and I grab the aluminum can that'll pay me to take it back across the scales, I pick up those plastic ones and make sure they get recycled as well.
That's great to hear.
On that issue, I've got well water where I live. And it's, I guess, soft water. It feels like you're kind of slimy when you're done bathing in it. The soap doesn't come off good or well. And I don't know if it's a function of this particular breed or this particular dog's age or what. We had a little Yorkie that his body weight doubled. And we had one vet wanted to put him down talking about congestive heart failure. And the minute we got that little dog in, we had to give him water pills. And we got one that likes to run away because she got too much freedom too soon now. But that's all separate issues.
Yeah.
Once we moved him on city water, he was fine.
Well, that's good to know, David. Thank you very much for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a minute with Megan O'Neill of treehugger.com.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Megan O'Neill. She is the editor of treehugger.com, and her new book is called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco-Living. You can join us by sending email to think at kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Megan, when I was a kid, I remember being told that turning the lights off and then turning them back on again a few minutes later wasted more electricity than leaving them on the whole time. I don't know if it was even true then, but it's definitely not true now.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there's a few things like that that have either changed throughout the past, you know, few years or decades, or that are, you know, common misconceptions. So turning the lights on and off, especially if you have traditional incandescent light bulbs, is actually a good idea if you're leaving the room. It will save energy to turn them off, even if you're just leaving for a few minutes.
And the same goes for your car, is that right?
That's right. That's another big misconception. So for most modern cars, turning your car off and turning it back on is actually more efficient, more fuel efficient, and creates less emissions than leaving it running. So if you're picking up the kids from school, or if you are, chatting with a friend on the side of the road, you really should turn that engine off.
And I guess 10 seconds is really the cutoff. If it's more than 10 seconds, you start to save energy. And you write that people in Japan actually do this at every stoplight.
They do. There are a few towns over there where it's sort of become this this trend where people, they just do it. They're super conscious about what their emissions and their fuel costs are like, and they turn their cars off at stoplights, believe it or not. There's also technology that can do that for the car itself. It's called stop-start technology. Some hybrid cars use this, and some internal combustion engine cars, traditional cars, use that as well in Japan, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a question on the microwave-safe bags that steam vegetables that you put in the microwave. Mm-hmm. How safe are those for your health?
Well, you know, I suppose it sort of depends on which brand you're using, and I can't speak to that specifically. But many of those bags, along with the popcorn bags as well, are lined with a plastic-type liner called BPA, or bisphenol A, and that chemical has been under attack lately in the news for being pretty dangerous. It can be an endocrine disruptor, which means that it can mess up your hormones. So it's really not something you want to expose yourself to, and particularly little kids, you want to keep away from those types of chemicals as well.
And speaking of little kids, there are biodegradable diapers. Compostable diapers, I'm sorry.
Yeah, biodegradable compostable diapers. There's a brand called G Diapers, which makes these, and they are sort of the best of both worlds, I guess, when it comes to, you know, the cloth versus disposable debate. And they have a little liner that you sort of put in a reusable panty, and you can pull them out and flush them or throw them in your compost when they're after they've been used.
That's what I see. So you're actually reducing even the amount of sort of disposable portion in these diapers.
That's right. Yeah, you're reducing the amount of waste or resources that you're using to create the diaper, and then of course reducing the amount of stuff that you're sending to the landfill too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Megan O'Neill. Her new book is called Ready, Set, Green. Let's go next to Arlington and talk to Pete. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Chris. As always, great program and a really interesting guest. Sort of a comment to introduce the question. In the early years of the space program, some of the early environmentalists used to draw the analogy of spaceship Earth, the analogy being that people in spaceship had unrenewable resources, and so they had to conserve them. My question is, although you're doing a great job of discussing the techniques and processes of living green, how do you address the cultural values of plenty and assumption when what you're ultimately asking people to do is live in a culture of assumed scarcity? And I'll take my question offline. Thank you.
It's a great question. Thanks, Pete.
It's a great question. Yeah, I think so, too. And one of the things that we are trying to do at Tree Hugger and Planet Green is sort of what I like to call getting people to think like a tree hugger. And what that means is, Yes, there's certainly these one-off changes that we can make, changing out a light bulb or buying one less shirt in a season or something like that. But I think that you're absolutely right. We need to get people to start thinking in a new way and changing their behaviors based on those things. I love the idea of Spaceship Earth because the population of the planet is about 5 times bigger than it was just 100 years ago, and to think that we as a species aren't having an impact on the environment where we live is sort of a silly assumption now.
We have an email from Matthew in Dallas who says, yes, each person can collectively do a lot, but it's still tinkering around the edges. Only with strong, aggressive mandates at federal, state, and city levels will we have a mechanism to become truly green and truly sustainable. Do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I think that individuals can have a really big impact in a few different ways. I think that the first thing is that our individual actions may be small, but when we multiply them by millions of people doing them, they do add up. The bigger idea, of course, is this sort of cultural or social shift. So if we all make these changes and we teach these values to our neighbors and our communities, our friends, our children, we're going to begin to see a cultural shift grow. And I think that that is what's going to lead also to bigger changes in our government. I mean, the government is made up of people. People need to make and want these changes.
So I've always heard that obviously it's better to run your dishwasher when it's completely full, but I didn't realize that a dishwasher is a more effective way to get things clean than hand washing.
Yeah, it's actually a big bonus for going. We're encouraging you to use your dishwasher. Modern dishwashers that are energy efficient use just about 4 or 5 gallons per load. Doing the same amount actually uses about 15 gallons. So you can save almost 5,000 gallons a year of water by using your dishwasher.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Megan O'Neill, who is an editor of treehugger.com. Her new book is called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco-Living. Let's speak next to Dan in Fort Worth. Hi, Dan.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about cars running on water. I was pointed to several websites by an acquaintance that have kits that claim to retrofit gasoline engines to run on water. And I just wonder if that is actually happening or whether it's a technology that's been debunked. I'm not sure how to go about finding out.
Is that urban legend, Megan?
That run on water, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's 3 different products on the web that claim to be able to do that.
You know, I have to admit I'm not familiar with this technology. I'd love to learn more about it. There's definitely ways to retrofit your engine to run on diesel or biodiesel. I know there's a kit called Grease Car, which is pretty interesting. You can actually use, like, restaurant grease. But I haven't heard of a water kit. I'd be very curious to learn more about that, unless, of course, it's steam engine, which we all know.
Unfortunately, water is not the source of fuel in the steam engine.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Since we're talking about water, you recommend washing clothes in cold water. Do we need a sort of heavy-duty detergent, or can the regular stuff still work?
No, you can use the regular stuff. And in fact, I'd encourage you to use the greener stuff. Washing your clothes in cold water will get them just as clean, but you will save energy and carbon emissions because you won't be heating up the water.
800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's go next to Jason in Dallas. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I had a question about recycling, and specifically, how much of an average household's waste is recyclable versus non-recyclable? And my question stems from in Dallas, we have recycling pickup once every other week, but we have a regular garbage pickup twice a week. So I'm wondering is it really 20%?
Yeah, I think it's probably really 20%. I mean, it depends too on what your municipal program is. But in addition to what your municipality picks up, many of the materials in your household may be recyclable beyond that. So if you think about all of the things in your house, TVs, computers, cell phones, you know, plastics that might be recyclable, but that your particular town might not pick up. Many of these materials are indeed recyclable.
We put links on our website, the think page of KERA.org, to the Dallas and the Fort Worth recycling programs. And I took a look at both of them again this morning, and they're pretty liberal. They accept really a lot. In the book, you talk about a lot of different plastics that can be recycled but often aren't. And we do most of them here, which is
a good thing. That's great. That's great. I wish my town did more.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Reeves in Dallas. Hi, Reeves.
Hi. I live here in Dallas in University Park, and all my neighbors use these lawn crews that use the gasoline-powered leaf blowers, weed whackers, and lawn mowers, and it's really sort of overkill on these postage stamp-sized lawns and garden areas. And I just wondered when there's going to be a movement to rectify the situation, because those the landscaping crews contribute between 5% and 10% of our air pollution, putting out benzene and producing smog chemicals, not to mention the noise, which sort of makes you not want to go on a walk. And even though we're in a nice walking area with sidewalks, you've run the gauntlet of these lawn crews, and you certainly don't want to encounter one. So what's being done to change this? I know Janet Napolitano in Arizona has banned the use of gasoline-powered lawn equipment completely. What can we do here? I have a garden that's pretty xeriscaped, and we let our leaves lie, and in the spring we have wildflowers.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that you know, what we need to do is probably what you're doing. We have a very strange attachment to grass and the lawn, I think, in the U.S. in general. We love our lawns, but what we don't realize is that we're using billions and billions of gallons of water a year to keep our lawns green, and instead of fighting what wants to grow there, the wildflowers and xeriscaping, what she's talking about is the idea of using native and drought-resistant plants in an area so that they are thriving in the natural environment instead of needing to douse them with water. The added benefit of that is that we're often growing plants that don't need to be mowed, so we're also lessening noise pollution, air pollution, using fewer fossil fuels, and that sort of thing. So I think you're absolutely right. We really need to step back and think about what it is that we're growing, and I think it's also very important that we think of our lawns, our yards, as corridors for wildlife. We're not separate from the birds that are migrating over our houses. They too need the natural foliage and landscape of our areas to subsist.
You know what's so strange about the lawn thing, I think, Megan, is that in the backyard a lot of people want their kids to run around and all that. Most people don't hang out on the front lawn ever.
Right. So. Right. No, you're absolutely right. And there is a small movement growing for where people are using their front lawns to grow fruit trees, for example, or they're planting things that don't need to be watered and mowed, because it's lessening their impact in an area that they don't really use to sit on. It doesn't really need to have grass.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Ed in Plano writes, there's more to efficiency than just energy consumption. For example, activating or deactivating various devices generally wears them out. Turning off incandescent lights for a short time does decrease power consumption, but shortens their lifespan. Similarly, constantly stopping and starting the engine on your car will shorten the lifespan of the starter system. Replacing these devices incurs all sorts of pollution, often in excess of the savings. Where that breakpoint lies is the critical question. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very important that we think about all of these things. And with anything, when we're talking about environmentalism, we do absolutely have to look at the entire life cycle of a product or a process in order to determine whether or not it's, you know, where the efficiency lies and what the effectiveness is. For the specific things that he's talking about, I mean, yes, I think that if you're sitting there, like my 1.5-year-old son likes to do, and flicking the light switch on and off, you're probably not doing the planet or your light bulbs or your energy bill any favors. But if you're, you know, leaving the kitchen after cooking dinner to go into the dining room or the family room or something, you want to turn the lights off. You know, I think there's a balance there between doing things efficiently and turning off and turning on. You know, just from a practical standpoint, if you're stopped at a stoplight or a stop sign, you're probably not going to turn your car engine off and back on. But if you're stopped and waiting for the kids, you know, at school for a few minutes, you do want to turn the car off. I think that that's probably wise.
Here in Texas, we know how much energy it uses, but we find it impossible nearly to live without air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how much of a difference, say, a solar-powered attic fan would make?
Sure, yeah. There's a lot of really great options for, you know, heating and cooling to make a home more efficient. So I can't speak to the specific efficiency of a solar-powered attic fan per se, but there are certainly techniques that we can use that are more efficient, and attic fans are one. Of course, it depends how they're installed and if they're done properly and this sort of thing, but there's also the idea of actually from the get-go building a house so that it captures the natural breezes off the landscape and this sort of thing, or positioning the house so that the solar gain is, you know, done in such a way that you're creating warmth in the winter but creating shade in the summertime. I certainly wouldn't expect anyone in Texas to live without air conditioning. It would be deadly hot, of course. But, you know, we do just want to be as efficient as possible and still be comfortable.
Megan O'Neill is my guest. Her new book is called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco-Living. She is an editor at treehugger.com and at planetgreen.com. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Megan O'Neill, co-author of a new book called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco-Living. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Megan, what is a dual-flush toilet?
A dual-flush toilet is a toilet that has two valves on it, essentially, so that you can use one flush for liquid waste, one for solid, and it uses a different amount of water for each type of flushing that you're using. And that's going to save water every time you flush. We use an amazing amount of water to flush down the toilets, believe it or not.
In fact, most of our water use in the average household goes to toilets. Is that right?
It does. It's actually sort of scary, isn't it? We're flushing valuable water down the drain, literally, without even thinking about it. You know, there are some of the more modern toilets only use about a gallon and a half or a few gallons for each flush, but some older toilets use up to 5 gallons per flush, and that's really an astounding amount of water when you think about worldwide. We all know that the Earth is covered in about 75% water. Only about 3% of that is actually fresh water, and only 1% of that is actually available for human consumption. So when we think about water in those terms, we realize that it's actually a pretty precious resource.
Well, and I don't know how long it takes for this to pay for itself, but replacing a toilet is one of the least expensive things you can do in the house, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty inexpensive. And in fact, in our house, what we've done is actually not replace the whole toilet, but just the tank, so that it just has the little equipment in there that you need to have a dual flush toilet, and you haven't even had to replace the heavy ceramic base of the toilet at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tracy in Dallas. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. I've got questions for Megan about recycling paper. The first is that I read a book called Cradle to Cradle, and he talks about in there how much chlorine is used in recycling paper. And I guess I'm wondering, is there some technology coming down the pike that would allow to recycle paper without the use of the high levels of chlorine? And then secondly, if you're aware of any paper alternative that might be coming out. We use an incredible amount of paper with our kids for crafts, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cradle to Cradle is a wonderful book for people who don't know it, written by a chemist and a architect who sort of rethink the way we design things. And their book itself is actually made instead of from paper, but it's actually made from a plastic type polymer that's endlessly recyclable, so it can continually be recycled into the same quality product, quote-unquote paper in this case. Paper does use a lot of chlorine, which creates dioxin, which is a toxic chemical when it's recycled. So the best thing that we can do is use paper that is made from post-consumer recycled content, which is not made from virgin resources. In terms of not using chlorine to recycle or remake paper, I don't know if there's another way to do it. I hope that there are ways to do it with less chemicals, and I suspect that there are, but I don't know if there's a completely clean, so to speak, way to do it as of yet.
We have an email from Barrett who writes, I am drawing a lot of attention with my new push mower. Hope it catches on. I have a push mower myself, and it's probably my favorite household tool.
There's sort of an old-timey wonderfulness to using a push mower, isn't there?
I feel like my dad out there, actually.
Yeah, and, you know, people who are sort of really lawn purists love the way that these push mowers cut. Of course, it makes sense if you have a small lawn, and the caller that called earlier, you know, was talking about the postage size stamped lawns being mowed with these sort of overkill, overzealous gasoline powered mowers. I think they're a great option if you have a small yard. Of course, if you've got a big yard, you might need to come up with a different option.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Paul in Arlington. Hey, Paul.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
Good. I was calling in, and first and foremost, I really wanted to say that I appreciate the content of this discussion and really what's trying to go on here. Individual advancement and movement toward a sustainable living environment is one of my biggest goals in life, but my main concern, and I guess what my question pertains to, is with such big business and political, apathy and motivation to drive toward a consumer society. We are moving further and further away from a sustainable lifestyle as Americans when we're being encouraged to buy as much as possible, to use as much as possible, to drive as much as possible, to replace everything as often as possible. How do we go about combating that lifestyle and that culture that's being ingrained on a mass scale as individuals, and what's being done in order to, I guess, provide an alternative for individuals who are looking for alternatives?
I think that this is such an important and interesting question because it's a conundrum that we're all faced with as environmentalists. And I think that even people who aren't environmentalists, anyone that has a kid sort of understands this conundrum because we're all marketed to all the time, right? Like you want this new toy, car, CD, whatever it is, and it's the way the world works right now. I think that the first line of action as an individual is to say, no, I'm not going to succumb to that. I don't need 15 new T-shirts every season. I only need 5, you know, and you reduce what it is that you as a consumer are actually buying. On the other hand, I think that, you know, places that are sort of encouraging consumerism, you know, many people might look at a Walmart, say, and say, oh, they're encouraging consumerism. On the other hand, we all do need stuff sometimes. I think that very few of us are ready to go live off the grid in a cave and never, you know, touch a computer or a telephone or a soda can again. And in that sense, these huge consumerist entities have the power to affect supply chains and, you know, really force sustainability on the suppliers themselves. So when Walmart says we're only going to sell compact fluorescent light bulbs, that has a huge impact on the market. And when they say we're not going to sell baby bottles that have the chemical BPA in them, that makes a huge impact on consumers and the market, because the consumers are realizing what they maybe should be buying, and the suppliers are realizing what they need to sell now to Walmart. So I think that there's a combination of things going on, and it's a very, very complicated issue, and it's certainly at the root of the idea of sustainability at large.
Will you talk for a minute, Megan, about the issue of greenwashing?
Sure, yeah. Greenwashing, I sort of like to say that greenwashing is in the eye of the beholder, because, you know, greenwashing, as it's defined, sort of means the idea of a company or a corporation marketing something as green that maybe isn't green. Now, we might look at something like a chemical cleaner, for example. Well, is it significantly greener than anything else that this company has sold before? If the answer is yes, is it greenwashing for them to promote it as green? Well, maybe yes and maybe no. Is it the greenest thing possible? Probably not. But does that mean that it's having an impact on the industry and making it more available to the consumer to make a better choice? If the answer is yes, then we can see how the idea of greenwashing becomes very murky. Unfortunately, we're sort of in that murkiness right now as a market, where consumers, I think, have to be very, very aware, and they really have to care about what they're buying and what's being marketed to them in order to avoid greenwashing, or to decide what greenwashing is according to their own principles.
Is there a functionality on TreeHugger, on Planet Green, where people can sort of look objectively at particular consumer products or anywhere else online?
Yeah, there are a few websites dedicated to greenwashing. We on TreeHugger sort of look at products on a case-by-case basis as they come out, and we try to be very fair, sort of according to the ideas that I just laid out. You know, so we try to look at, you know, what chemicals, for example, is this company using compared to what they used to use and compared to what the ideal is. So we try to educate people in that way to sort of open their eyes and say, not just this is the answer, but here are the questions to ask.
So you have to start with reality, essentially.
Yeah, you have to start with reality. You do.
Let's go next to Garland and talk to Missy. Hi, Missy.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. I wanted to comment first on the recycling and how you're saying about 20% is recycling. 20% of our garbage could be recycled. I actually feel that it can be more than that. In our family, we recycle just about everything, even toilet paper rolls and everything. We generate very little garbage. We mostly just throw away foodstuffs and things that, you know, you can't recycle. And our garbage collection comes once a week, but we don't even have to put the dumpster out half the time because there's maybe one sack in there. It's really not even, we'll forget and we'll, oh, well, it's not even full. And I think that the problem is the recycling truck only comes once or twice a month to our neighborhood, and they're very picky about what they will pick up. So we end up with a bunch in our garage collected, and we just have to make a trip up to the recycling center. And I just wish that it was switched, where the recycling came once or twice a week and the garbage was only once a month. That would be wonderful. But
maybe we'll get there.
Yes. And my question for you is about sippy cups. I have two small children, and they drink from the plastic sippy cups. And you were talking about the chemicals, BS or BPA, I forget what you called. And I've heard that it's more likely to be released when plastics are washed in the hot water of the dishwasher and on the hot dry and everything. And so I try to hand wash them, but then I heard earlier you commenting that you actually use more water with hand washing than you do with dishwashing. So I feel like I'm stuck. So what do you recommend?
Yeah, well, first of all, I totally applaud your recycling efforts and your efforts to minimize your waste. I think that is awesome, and you are exemplary, so bravo. When it comes to BPA and the baby bottles, you're absolutely right. It is, you are at higher risk for that chemical leaching into the liquid that your kids are drinking or eating when that plastic is heated up. So this is a very big concern to people with small children who are heating up bottles, for example. With the sippy cups, it depends, first of all, on what type of plastic the sippy cup is made from. So if it's made from a polycarbonate plastic, that's the type of plastic that you would want to worry about. If it's not made from that type of plastic, you're probably okay. You can find plastics and sippy cups that are BPA-free now. So that would eliminate the dishwasher versus hand washing dilemma.
Well, and either way, letting them cool probably would reduce some of the risk. Is that right?
It reduces some of the risk, yeah. I mean, you know, ideally you're using a cup that's BPA-free. You know, in this sort of situation, and this is one of the things that we really talk about in the book, is that all of the tips and tricks and knowledge that we're giving you are meant to sort of equip you with the own tools in your life to do what works for you. So someone who doesn't have kids isn't worried about hand washing the sippy cups. In this situation, if washing the sippy cups by hand makes more sense for you, then by all means, you know, that's the balance and the choice that you have to make. I think it's so important to realize that these aren't hard and fast rules. It's information that's put out there to help you understand how to find this balance between health and your pocketbook and you know, your environmental impact. And that's sort of what all of this information is really about.
Before we let you go, Megan, I read that 3 out of 5 staffers at treehugger.com don't own cars. I'm wondering about the sort of taboos that exist when you work in a place like that.
It's a great question. You know, I think that we always talk amongst ourselves and try to be very honest and transparent with our readers that we are by no means perfect. So yeah, a lot of our staffers aren't using cars, but a lot of our staffers are not vegetarians either, you know. So when you work in a place like this, it's not so much about focusing on what we're not doing green, but it's more about sort of being in this community where we sort of help each other see how we can do it in our own lifestyles. And we're everything from people living in cities to out in the country to people that only ride bikes to people that drive SUVs. You know, we're by no means perfect. We're merely trying to figure out better ways in our variety of different lifestyles that we each live.
Megan O'Neill is editor of planetgreen.com and treehugger.com. Her new book is called Ready, Set, Green, 8 Weeks to Modern Eco-Living. Megan, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.